If you've listened to this program for a long time, you probably have heard about the Starchild skull. Well, we're going to get an update from Lloyd Pye on this, on the DNA information, and then we're going to talk with him about some other incredible issues on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd Pye, he joined the Army and became an agent for military intelligence, and during this time he began an independent study of human evolution. His studies led him to conclude that humans could not possibly have evolved on Earth according to the Darwinian paradigm. By age 40, he could illustrate his belief by comparing skeletons in the so-called pre-human fossil record with those reported to belong to the world's four basic types of hominoids. Lloyd is probably best known as the caretaker of the famous Starchild skull, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hello, my friend. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm fine, and I'm very happy to be with you again.
Always a pleasure. There's incredible times, Lloyd. You were last on with me in March, and just in these few months, man, the bottom has fallen out, huh?
Well, actually, it was March a year ago. So
yes.
It's been like 20 months since I've been on, actually.
Oil prices were high then.
Yeah.
So what's new with the Starchild Project?
Well, we have a terrific announcement to make to everybody who's been following it for the 10 years that it's been going on. It'll be 10 years in February, if anyone can believe
and
that.
And you better review the Starchild Project, too, because we've got lots of new listeners.
Okay. The Starchild is a real, true bone skull. It's not a crystal skull. It's not cobbled together. It's a real skull that, you know, anybody can look at, and thousands of people have, and can tell that it's real, but it's very unlike a human skull. It's got many, many really, really divergent qualities about it. The bone is half as thick as normal human bone. It weighs half as much, and yet it's two or three times as hard. And part of that hardness has to do with some fibers of some kind that are woven through the matrix of the bone. Now, a lot of people write me and say, well, wouldn't those fibers be Morgellons fibers? No, they're not. Morgellons fibers are visible to the eye, and they seem to be to come to the skin and organs, whereas these fibers are microscopic in size, and they're woven into the matrix of the bone itself. So it's like comparing apples and oranges. Plus, these fibers, for whatever they're constructed of, they're very durable because they frayed. The reason we found them is the tips of them frayed out while the bone was being cut by a Dremel blade. So they're just not found. These fibers are not found in any other known bone of any kind of species at all. So there's that. There's the size of the brain in the skull. It should be about 1,200 cubic centimeters. If this was a human, even with the shape of the head, it should be about 1,200 cubic centimeters. It's 1,600 cubic centimeters of brain packed into that head, and we don't really understand how that can be done. The thinness of the bone, it completely lacks sinuses. It has very shallow eye sockets. But that still doesn't account for all the extra brain in there. We really don't understand yet how that works. The knot that all human beings have in the back of their heads, if you reach around to your own head right now and go down to the lower rear part of it, you'll feel a knot there. Everybody has that. It's called the external occipital protuberance, or the inion. If you're a monkey, if you're a chimp, if you're a gorilla, if you have a neck attaching to a head, you've got that bump because it's a bracing point for big muscles that attach there. Starchild doesn't have that. It has a dent where that is a normal bump, and it's pretty clear that it's a well-built dent. It's perfect. And that's another thing. The Starchild, for as weird as it is, it's completely symmetrical. It's very, very shallow eye sockets, have a complete redesign for the openings for the optic nerve.
It's not like a deformity. It's almost like the pieces all fit, like a puzzle.
The pieces do fit. That's exactly right, George. It's clearly not a deformity. One of the hallmarks of deformity is asymmetry, and one of the amazing aspects of the Starchild is how incredibly symmetrical it is, how symmetrical everything is about it. So what it means is its genes are telling it to grow this way that it has, and those genes are telling it to grow exactly different than humans. So this tells us that its whole genetic package is going to be different, and that's what's exciting about what's coming up, because we did work toward, for the early years of this project, we did work toward getting a DNA test. At first, there were only six labs in the world that could do the ancient DNA testing that the Star Child required, because it's 900 years old. Carbon-14 dating tested out at 900 years old. So if anything is over 50 years, that's considered ancient DNA, and it requires a lot of very special testing.
And that's expensive.
That was expensive. So we had to work for years to get to that point, but in 2003 we got there. At first, as I was saying, those six labs, none of them would touch it. So we had to wait for a few years until there were more labs doing that kind of work. And finally, we got one that was willing to do it. And so they did, and what they found in 2003 using primers, which was all the technology permitted at the time, was that the Star Child's mother was indeed a human being and its father was not. It was clearly not a normal human being. And I have the photographs of the test results on your website so people can see how clear this is. The mitochondrial DNA was recovered very easily, but and the human found with it as well, but the Star Child's nuclear DNA was not recovered in six attempts. So we know its mother was human. We know its father was not a typical human. But what we didn't know was how far away that it fell. Now, we were told in 2003, if you wait 3 to 5 years, there will be a test available that will allow the sequencing of the entire genome, and we will be able to tell you exactly how far this guy was from human. So we've just had to basically sit for 5 years. Here we are, 5 years later from 2003.
Let technology catch up to you.
Yep, exactly, and it has. But unfortunately, as that new technology came on board, it's vastly more expensive, $200,000
to do
that testing. I know. So
just write a check, Lloyd.
Yeah, right. Write a check, exactly. $200,000. But it gives you what you need to prove what the Star Child is. Well, finally, here just recently, we've been contacted and are making a deal with a British major outfit, documentary outfit, to make a one-hour documentary on the Star Child, part of which is going to go over the history of what got us to this point, but they're going to follow through on and film the testing, the major aspects of the testing. And the documentary showing the results is going to be broadcast next year around the world. So it will start in England, and they have become, in order to pay for that bill, to pay for that humongous bill, they've had to bring in some partners, one of which is one of the major networks in the U.S. to show it here in the U.S. and Canada and around the world. So I'm here tonight to alert the community, the alternative community, you and everybody else, that we are now lining ourselves up in position to win our argument, and the Star Child can do it. And it's going to be the thing, I think, that's going to nail it down that alien life did exist on the Earth at least once 900 years ago, and the Star Child is going to be the proof.
That's amazing. Let's talk about the possibilities. First of all, the people of this time period, and the indigenous people, they had a way, especially the Incans, to stretch the skull, did they not?
Well, all people have the ability to bind head skull, bind skulls and reshape them. Yes, absolutely.
Now, here's the paradox, though, Lloyd. Let's make just an assumption for a moment that the Star Child is all human.
Right.
It has a bizarre-shaped head. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
And if his head was stretched for whatever things were going on in the during that era, they might have been trying to copy, let's say, an extraterrestrial that was living with them at that time. That's a possibility, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, so that still tells you that there's been visitation here.
Right. Well, you would be more talking about, I think, the coneheads of Peru, which have those elongated heads.
Mm-hmm.
The star child's head is not elongated at all. It's merely flattened in its rear.
Is it more like a gray?
It's just flattened, but it's not flattened in the way you normally flatten a skull by pressing a board against it. Cradle boarding, the human that was found with the star child, that's a typical cradle board. It's a cradle boarded head, very clearly. But the star child is not, because it has the natural convolutions in its bone still there. We really have looked at carefully the idea that it might have been bound into that shape. One of the first things we looked at, and it's absolutely impossible for the star child to have been headbound, because when that happens, whatever you bind against the head, the bones are so soft in an infant that they take that shape. They absolutely flatten, as flat as the board that you put against the head. And the star child has no flattening of that. It has gross flattening, but it doesn't have fine detail flattening. You can run your hand down the back of it and feel convolutions, natural convolutions, all over it. So it absolutely was not headbound or distorted or stretched in any way. It grew into that shape, which is unique, by the way, because it has that crease down the middle of the back. You know that crease that people say when they see a gray, they say it looks like a heart-shaped
right.
face. It's got these big bulge, two big bulges at the top with a crease down the middle and a very narrow, fine, thin lower face. Star Child has that. It has all of that, the physiology of that. So if it was being bound in some way, I don't think you would get that neat crease down the middle of the back. The pressure of the changing of the shape of the head would push it out in all directions uniformly. You see what I mean?
Even the bound heads, to me, look very extraterrestrial.
Absolutely. You know,
I'm not even sure those are human, even though they think they are.
The conehead. I'm with you on that, George. Yeah. I've been saying on this show time and again, somebody ought to do to the coneheads what I'm doing to the star child.
Absolutely.
Coneheads have just as much chance, but because of the cost, everybody is prohibited from doing it. But if we pull this off with the star child, I guarantee you, if money comes my way, one of the first things I'm going to want to do is do it again with a conehead, because I think we'll get the same result.
Can't we get a laboratory that is doing this kind of ancient testing to donate their time and energies for this?
Well, this isn't really ancient testing, George. This is a complete genome analysis, all 3 billion pairs.
Okay.
This is a huge amount of work.
Yep.
For it to be down to 200,000, right now, for the past 2 years, they've been doing the Neanderthal. They've been sequencing the Neanderthal using the technology that they had then, and it's cost several million dollars.
They may find out some incredible things about the Neanderthal.
Absolutely. Because, you know, what the whole purpose for developing this technology was to sequence the Neanderthal, because they want to know, was the Neanderthal closer to a chimp or closer to a human? Now, the mainstream is betting that it's very, very, very close to human. I'm betting that it's very, very, you know, much closer to chimp than human. I don't think Neanderthals were close to humans at all, relatively speaking, although they're saying that's what it's going to turn out. But I believe there's going to be amazing discoveries to come out of the Neanderthal genome once they put it all out there. And I understand it's supposed to have been done, and now they're, you know, analyzing and trying to put together the reports and all this. I think they've got some Lucy, you got some explaining to do.
Yeah, that's right, Ricky.
I think they're going to have some explaining to do when it comes to the Neanderthal.
Well, who has the Star Child skull right now? You still have it in your possession?
No, I haven't had the Star Child, the original, in my possession since we cut it into it the first time back in end of 99. The owners, Ray and Melanie Young in El Paso, they keep it very well secured under lock and key, because, you know, it's just going to be such a valuable thing. They did, in fact, for the first time, bring it out and put it on public display at the 60th anniversary of Roswell.
I remember
last
that.
July.
Yep.
Yeah, and it was there for people to see. So for the first time in all those years, and probably about 5,000 people made their way through that museum where it was to see it. So it was a pretty big event.
Now you've been writing a book about the Star Child, and it is out.
Right. Yes, I've published a book about the 8 years the up to 8 years. And that book is called The Star Child Skull, and we've got about 200 copies left of the hardback right now, still available that people can get. And I would urge everybody that's listening to get it. And I'm not trying to sell books, I'm not, but what is important is for people to get themselves fully aware that this is going on, this is going to happen. And I don't know any other way to do it except to get the book. If you can't get a copy of the hardback, get one from Amazon. Get a paperback from Amazon. They cost about $12-13. It's very cheap. And get it and read it and make yourself aware of it so you can talk to your friends about it. Make people aware that this is happening, and all of those people that put you down and say, oh, you're stupid, you don't know what you're talking about, aliens aren't real, forget it. You're going to win. You are going to win, and this is the thing that's going to allow you to win. But make yourself aware and understand so that you can present the case to them. The pictures are there. It's written in a very simple, basic way, and it's absolutely worth your time and effort to know about this, to educate yourself about this. Now, as far as the book itself goes, for those who want to get it, yeah, you go to www.bellapbooks.com, BellLapBooks.com, 3 L's there, and you can get the hardback. Now, that is going to be a collector's edition. I urge you to get it if you can. It's not that expensive at $30, and the shipping is free. But if you can't do that or don't want to do that, try to get a copy of the paperback. Share it with friends. I mean, get the information out. Make everybody aware of it. This is an exciting thing in our field. This is a huge breakthrough. It's what everybody's been waiting for, and when we should celebrate it every way we can.
Will the documentary happen whether the genome DNA testing is done or not?
Right. The documentary is going to film through to the end, and we will have what's called the Eureka moment, where the result comes in and we'll know what it is. It's about a 3 to 4 month process to do the whole genome, and then once the data's in, it has to be analyzed by experts so that, you know, we know what we're saying. And the great thing about the DNA, George, is that it just says what it says. You can do it over again and over again and over again. There's no fiddling with it. It's done on such a broad scale, and there's so much of it to be done. I can't imagine we've looked at how can this thing be fiddled with? How can this thing be sabotaged? We don't really think that it can. It's just too big a project to sequence all 3 billion base pairs, and with a camera looking over everybody's shoulder at every step of the way, we feel like we're going to get the right answer. So whatever that answer is, this company will have invested over $500,000 in getting it done when all is said and done. So they're not going to just, you know, they're going to put it out there, whatever it is.
You know,
and I'm for that. I've been for that all along. Let's just find out what it is and put it out there.
Well, what's amazing is all the money that they use for these bailouts. You would think that science would be able to raise the money to get this project done, which could have profound impact on society and for our belief system.
Well, George, this is not an answer they want. This is not going to be a happy day for them when they wake up the next day after this, and they've known that all along. Nobody on their team wants that.
Yeah.
We're on our team, right? We're pulling for it to go our way because for us it's going to be a great thing. It's going to be a great win. It's going to put us in the win column finally. We're not going to be, you know, batting zero forever. And they are going to have an awful lot to deal with, an awful lot of excuses to make, an awful lot of explaining. Again, we'll see, you got some explaining. It's going to be bad for them, and they know that. So nobody has helped, to push that along, and nobody wants to. So that's why it's taken 10 years to do something that could have been done. Well, given the technology of the time, no. We've had to wait 10 years, but we could have maybe gotten this started, you know, a year ago, maybe, if somebody had been willing to help us out.
Lloyd, when we come back, I want to get your take on the visitation. If your theory is correct, I want you to kind of explain to us what you think happened 900-plus years ago. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Lloyd Pye on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Lloyd Pye with us. Lloyd, let's go back then. Are you saying that the visitations occurred 900 years ago or even farther back?
Well, they could definitely have been farther back. They could also have been recently. All we're going to be able to do is pin one down at 900 years ago, plus or minus 40 years. I happen to believe in the testimony of women who claim that they are harvested even to this day, meaning that they are taken on board, they are made pregnant, they go to a doctor, they have a sonar scan, they are pregnant, no doubt about it. And then in the fourth month, in the start of the second trimester, they lose it. They have all the signs of a miscarriage with no fetus. And then some years later, they'll be taken on board and they'll be shown their child. I have on my in the book, I have an explanation and drawings from a woman named Josie Galante in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And she had that experience well before the star child came to light, and she drew her little five-year-old son that she saw in this way, and the outline of his head, front and back, we have the star child superimposed, the star child skull superimposed on her drawing, which, again, she created before the star child knowledge was known, and it just fits remarkably well. Also in the book, you can see another story even more interesting to me. A man in 1978, a lawyer, was taken on board, and he saw them, and he had a good memory of what he had seen, and he hired a sculptor to sculpt a bust of the Greys that he dealt with, the aliens that he dealt with in 78. And same thing, when you put the star child, you superimpose it over that bust. Again, it's a remarkable likeness. And then you put the boy that Josie drew and the star child skull and the sculpture together side by side, and it's remarkable. These are the kind of things that are in the book. And by the way, I hate to do this, but I forgot to say that this is important. For those who want to get the hardback, if you can't get it online, there is an 800 number, 1-800-992-4821. That's 1-800-992-4821. Get it online if you can. If you can't, that's the way to do it. The hardback. Otherwise, just go to Amazon and get the paperback.
Lord, let's go back now. This is high speculation on your part, but I want you to kind of paint us a picture on this visitation. If indeed you are correct, the mother is human, the father is not. Tell me what you think happened back then.
Well, first of all, it's not speculation. The mother's human, the father's not. That's what the DNA showed clearly in 203. So we've got that to work with. Now, how did it happen? I do not think it happened by a natural sexual union. I think it had to have happened genetically in a lab, in vitro. I don't think any of the women today who claim that this happens to them say that it happens from a natural sexual union. It's done with needles through their navel, and you know, we all know the stories of that, how they tell that it happens, and I believe that that's their way of in vitro fertilizing them. And I don't think you can get a natural union between beings that are so far different. So I think that the star child was probably an in vitro laboratory creation. And understand, when we say that the star child is a hybrid between a human being and something else, people tend to think that automatically means, well, 50-50.
Right.
But it isn't like that. Even with you and me.
And also a natural birth.
Exactly that, too. But even with you and I, we are more like our mothers, or, you know, 60-40 like our dad or our mother, or 70-30 even. But when you do it genetically, when you do it in a lab, you can make it whatever you want it to be. You can make it 90% one and 10% the other. That's still a hybrid. But it's very narrow in on the side of one of them. I think personally that the star child, when we are able to look at its whole genome, if you go on just the skull, George, and you look at the 24 two dozen major physiological differences between it and a normal human, understanding that every one of those differences requires a different gene than a normal human gene, when you look at those and you extrapolate that out across the whole body, I think that the difference is going to be like 90% whatever the dad was and 10% human, maybe even 5%. I think the difference is going to be marked, extreme, perhaps even larger than the difference between a human being and a chimp. I think when the star child is completely sequenced, the difference between a chimp and a human is 3%, and look how different a chimp is. The star child could be 3%, it could be 5%, it could be even more. Now, that's going to be such a bombshell, but even if it's 1%, if it's just only 1 full percent, that's huge. That's absolutely huge in the world of genetics because, again, a chimp is 3%, a gorilla is 5% away from human. But if you just look at how many physiological differences in the skull, it tells me, it tells those of us that, you know, under, that have, you know, read the book enough and really understand the mechanics of how it was how this unfolded, you realize, God, this thing is so different, it can't not come up. Just incredibly.
How many of them do you think they genetically altered? I mean, you've only found this one.
Right.
There's got to be more.
Well, I think, George, what it is yeah, I think there's a major ongoing program, and there has been for, who knows, thousands of years. Who knows what these beings are created for? But I think that they're created. We've got something they need to make a being that is going to function better in a certain place. And I think those beings are taken, those children are taken to whatever place they're going to. I don't think they're made for like food or anything like that. They're made for to populate a place. And that place needs something we have in the same way that I believe we were put here, too. I think we were genetically engineered and put here. Well, those beings that are using some of our DNA and some of somebody else's DNA are being put somewhere else. And so it's an ongoing program. How the star child escaped that, how the star child managed to escape the net, so to speak, was only because the human that was found with it in the mine tunnel deliberately wanted to somehow not have it found. So she went way out into the boonies. She found a mine tunnel. She went in there, and she buried it in there, and she killed herself and died with it. And so she made an effort to have this result. Now, the odds on 900 years later, a 15-year-old girl stumbling into that mine tunnel and finding those bones and bringing them out, and then, you know, 70, 80 years after that, falling into the hands of Ray and Melanie Young, and then them getting in touch with me, all of that is like it's the equivalent of the shepherd finding the Dead Sea Scrolls. But it happened. I mean, it just happened, and we get to deal with that, the result of whatever that's going to turn out to be. But I think nearly all of them are recovered and taken to wherever they want to, and the star child somehow escaped the net. That's how I interpret it.
Amazing. Truly, truly remarkable.
I think so.
What might have been going on this planet a long time ago. And here's another thought, too, Lloyd. This also, you know, there is some similarities with the star child and what some of these Egyptian sculptures look like in those days. Most of them a little more elongated, at least the pharaoh's heads. What about the possibility this was going on all around the planet at that time?
Well, at 900 years ago, the Egyptians were pretty much long gone as far as the classic Egyptian culture.
Right.
Also, the classic
type.
Egyptian, yeah, the classic Egyptian culture, the head elongation of like Akhenaten, for example, that is much more like the cone heads than the star child. Remember, the star child has a flattened rear gray type look, whereas the cone heads and Akhenaten and all have that. Like tubular, the crystal skull from the Indiana Jones movie. It looks much more like that than does the star child. The star child does not have a large head in that sense. It has a reconstructed head on the inside, but it's got a distinctive look. If you go on the website, www.starchildproject.com, and look at the pictures of it, you'll see it doesn't look anything like the cone heads. It doesn't look anything like the crystal skull in the Indiana Jones movie.
Now, which we're going to talk about next hour, by the way, crystal skulls.
But the star child is unique, George. People say to me, well, is there anything else like it in the world? No. Now, as far as I know, and believe me, if there's one thing I know now, it's weird skulls. I get every one of them out there sent to me. There is really nothing like it. I mean, absolutely not even in the ballpark. But the coneheads, there's a lot like them. There's hundreds of those in museums in Peru. Those were a people. Those were a race of beings living here on this planet at one time. The star Starchild is an absolutely one-off shot. There's been nothing else like it, and the only thing really close to it is Gray's. Grays consistently are described as looking like the Starchild. In fact, when we first thought that's what it was, the skull of a gray.
Where did they go? They were here. They mixed with humans. They genetically altered them. Where'd they go? Why'd they disappear?
Well, there's nobody says that they have, George. There's nobody says that they've gone. Nobody says they've disappeared. I think they're being seen on a regular basis. I think the women who claim they're being abducted and made pregnant and their children are being taken from them, I think that's going on, and I think it's been an ongoing project for at least 900 years around the world and probably for thousands of years prior to that. I don't know. It seems like maybe we're part of a part of a breeding population. I don't think that happens to a lot of women percentage-wise, but I think that it's been going on probably for...
They go. Why they disappear?
Well, there's nobody says that they have, George. There's nobody says that they've gone. Nobody says they've disappeared. I think they're being seen on a regular basis. I think the women who claim they're being abducted and made pregnant and their children are being taken from them, I think that's going on, and I think it's been an ongoing project for at least 900 years around the world and probably for thousands of years prior to that. I don't know. It seems like maybe we're part of a breeding population. I don't think that happens to a lot of women percentage-wise, but I think that it's been going on probably for thousands of years, and because in the records there are, as I understand it, there are mentions of things like that that go way back, way beyond 900 years. Now, I'm not a student of that game, but I've had people tell me that they know of evidence that it goes way back. I don't really know that's a fact, but I suspect that if it's going on 900 years ago, I see no reason why it couldn't go on both back in time and forward in time.
What a remarkable time this must have been on the planet a long time ago, Lloyd. If you accept the theories of Zechariah Sitchin and the visitations several hundred thousand years ago, and
right. This
planet appears to have been visited constantly, still is, and they're always genetically playing around with us.
Right. Well, I think this is a unique planet, George. If you look at the mechanics of the way solar systems form as we understand it, to have a planet covered in water the way this one is unique. I mean, to have one missing its skin, as you know, if you put any kind of a liquid in a vacuum and let it loose, what does it do? It pulls itself into the tightest ball that it can.
Mm-hmm.
So as any viscous substance, which is how planets are going to form, are starting out, they're going to pull into the tightest ball that they can. And if you look at every other planet in the solar system, that's what you get, except for the Earth. The Earth is unique. So there's a lot of stuff going on here because we're like an experimental ground or something.
Why are we unique? Why?
Well, I think because of the water. I think the fact that so much of the skin of the Earth is missing and was filled in by water.
The luck of the draw for us?
I think luck of the draw. I don't know. I don't think you could have manufactured a planet like this, something on that scale.
You don't think now, by design?
I don't see how it could be. I don't know
well
how,
thought out.
But the moon, you have those great arguments that the moon is a manufactured thing and it's put there.
John Lear believes it was towed into place.
Absolutely. Look, I've read those are good arguments. Who built the moon? That's a very good book. And the guys that wrote it make some very good arguments for that. So if you could do the moon, well, maybe the Earth, but the Earth is an awful lot bigger and it's dense and thick. The moon is apparently hot. So I don't know. The scale of it just boggles my mind. But what do I know? They're capable. They could do anything. Who knows what they're capable of? But Earth is unique. I know that much. Earth is unique as we understand planet formation.
The project in the documentary. I'm looking forward to this because I would just love to see this entire episode laid out. Now, will you take it from what they think happened 900 years ago, what you think happened?
You know, we're going to have our first face-to-face meeting with the producers in January. That's the schedule that we have right now. And I won't really know what their plans are for how that's going to happen until we sit down and hammer them out. They certainly want me to have a lot of input in that, and that's one of the things that I will recommend. If you read the book, the first opening scene is what the scenario that I envisioned based on what I was told about how the bones were found. But it is just a scenario. But something like that, a recreation of that, I think would be a good way to open it up. And then just that's what they tell me. They want to sort of go through the history of it through the first half hour to 40 minutes or so. And the last part, go through the testing and show how it's done, what went into it, follow the steps in the sequence, and then at the end have the result, whatever the result is.
And those results will spell out exactly what you think.
Exactly what we think. What we'll be able to do, George, is compare the Star Child's entire genome to a human genome, to a chimp genome, to a gorilla genome, and by that time, to the Neanderthal genome.
So what would they say? Again, you know, DNA from a non-human, what would the results show, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's going to show a percentage away from human that is so marked. So
and unknown, right?
Absolutely unknown. Just the same way the Neanderthal. Again, you just imagine if you would a line, and there's human, normal human. 3% away from that is a chimp. 5% away from that is a gorilla. Somewhere in there is going to fall the Neanderthal, and somewhere on that line is going to fall the Star Child. Now, the question is where? How far away from normal is it going to fall? Will it be 1%, 0.5%, 2%, 3%, 5%, 10%? Don't know. Don't know that with the Neanderthal either at this point, but there, we will know it by that time. So I think, based again on what I said earlier, that the skull itself is so different, and that the woman, when she saw the whole skeleton, she said it was all misshapen, equally misshapen. I think that all of its genes were telling it to grow different than a human being, and so I think it's going to be significantly away from the human norm to such a degree that nobody can argue that this isn't an alien being.
If we found Bigfoot and, you know, did the same kind of genome testing.
Right. We will do that.
Would we be able to determine whether this creature was indigenous to planet Earth or not?
Exactly that. We will be able to lay its entire genome down against a chimp and against a gorilla, and we'll be able to say exactly where it fits on that, you know, on that scheme of genetics.
And unknown means what?
Well, unknown just at this point means we don't have one to sample yet. But once you have a Bigfoot DNA and you're able to sequence it down to its full genome, we'll be able to compare it fully. And if you look at the physiology of the hominoids, Bigfoot and the others that are out there, and if you look at the physiology of the so-called prehumans, and that includes the hobbits, you see that they are all the same. They are really all the same. The hominoids are the prehumans. The Australopithecines, the early Australopithecines, Lucy, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, all of those are hominoids. Those are not human beings. They don't look human. Everything about them says primate.
Right.
Thick bones.
Slouchy, a little bit.
Exactly. Well, the way their heads are built, the big brow ridges, slanting foreheads. There's nothing like us until we appear. But if you look, you know, this is one of the things that I hope we can talk about later. If you look at what I've been saying all along about this since I started this 10 years ago, I've been saying that in the Miocene there had to be upright walking Miocene apes, and nobody was accepting that in mainstream science at that point. But now, just last year, it's come out that indeed there were upright walking Miocene apes as far back as 21.5 million years ago, certainly, and then again at 12 million years ago, certainly, with Morotopithecus at 21.5 and Pyrrolopithecus at 12 million years ago, and then you have Oreopithecus at about 8 million years ago. So you have these upright walkers clearly now in the Miocene saying that these creatures have been here, these upright walking primates have been here for at least 20 million years, and those are the living hominoids of today. They have a perfect sequence following all the way through to today, including the prehumans, which means human beings don't have a place on the flowchart.
Lloyd, I think we're the visitors. I think we're the visitors. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with Lloyd Pye on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, weren't you on an old History Channel documentary on the Star Child, or at least you were part of something?
Absolutely. Something. It's been on the History Channel, the Learning Channel, National Geographic Channel. It's been on about a half dozen of them. But it's always been as part of a larger hour. This one that's coming up in the fall of next year will be the first time that the Star Child has been treated to a full hour analysis.
That is fantastic.
And, it's pretty exciting. It really is. It's great news. It's really what we've all in the field, I think, been waiting for a very long time, and I'm just delighted to be able to announce it and let people know that they can start really looking forward to something dramatic happening toward the end of next year. The testing will be in the mid part of the year, but the documentary, they have to film it, they have to cut it, they have to, it's like preparing a book. It takes about a year to do a big one like this, and so we're just kicking it off, and we're very excited about it.
Still traveling, speaking?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just got back from Australia. You know, my wife Amy is from Australia, and mm-hmm. she hadn't been home in a while, so we went over there and did a speaking tour. And one of the things that we did was we went to the Nexus Conference. Nexus Magazine puts on a big conference every year down there, and we went to that one and were able to speak on the same program with the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, the famous Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. So that put the two most famous skulls in alternative knowledge on the same program. So people really turned out, and we had a great time with the individuals that came there, but also was able very fortunately to get a private audience with the Mitchell Hedges skull, spend like a half an hour with it, and they do that. They sell those slots to people who want to pay the money, the extra money for it. And we were there. One of them came up that Bill Holman just said, you know, I want you to come take a look at it just for free. So we did. My wife Amy and I and her mother. And when we saw it, it's an amazing thing for those who are not really aware of what makes the Mitchell Hedges skull so special.
It's named after an English adventurer, right?
Right. Well, it's named after his daughter who found it, Anna Mitchell Hedges. It's called that because that was her name, but she found it when she was a teenager. Ironically enough, this is so incredible. She was a teenager. It was her 17th birthday when she found the crystal skull. The woman who found the Star Child was a teenager of 14, 15 when she found it. So, you know, what are the odds of that? But anyway, we spent our time. Now, a lot of people want to be with any crystal skull because they want to feel the emanations from it that supposedly some people can feel. I was not part of that, nor was Amy or her mother. We didn't do that. We weren't able to experience that part of it. Maybe we're not open to it or whatever. But what we did do was spend our time talking to Bill about the physical mechanics of what makes this thing so special. And the average crystal skull, there's about 200 of them out there, other than this very special Mitchell Hedges one, which is just so perfect. And they are carved out of crystal of different kinds and different cloudiness, different levels. But this is absolutely clear crystal. It's amazing. Now, it does have occlusions and flaws and things in it, but this one, it's very, very remarkably clear. What makes it impossible is that when you normally cut a crystal, any kind of crystal, whether it's a diamond or any other jewel, the first thing you do is you line up the axis around which the crystal has grown. Crystals grow around like a seed, you know, and they have an axis. Well, this skull has at least three axes, and they argue that it may have a fourth, but the point is it's got three axes jumbled into it, and the thing has been cut against those axes, not along them, against them. Now, any other stone, it should have just exploded. It should not have held together. And yet somehow it did. And not only did they were they able to cut it out against the grain of the axes, they cut the jaw completely loose. Normally in a crystal skull, you just see some etching to represent the teeth, and the jaw is always a part of the block. You know, the jaw doesn't articulate. It doesn't come completely loose like a real jaw does on a human skull. So this one is clearly cut out of the same. I mean, they took in some years ago, they tested it at Hewlett-Packard, and they found out all these things about it that I'm describing, and one of which is they found out that the jaw and the skull came from the same block of quartz. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And yet somehow whoever did it was able to separate the jaw completely from the main body, again against the axes, and it should have just shattered, but somehow it didn't. That's what they can't figure out. And then on top of that, my wife Amy used to be a dental nurse in Australia, and so the first thing she did was start looking at the teeth and comparing the jaw and how it fit with the upper teeth. And she said to Bill Holman, "Do you realize that these occlusions and the cusps of the teeth fit in against each other?" And he said, "No, I don't know what you're talking about." And so in human teeth, you know, they have cusps and they have the little kind of valley down in the middle of the cusps, and those are called the occlusions. In perfect teeth, the upper and the lower teeth fit where the upper cusps fit into the bottom of the lower occlusions, and it's a nice tight fit. That is what this thing has. Somehow they were able to cut it that fine.
How could they
flat.
Do this? How they do this?
Well, it can only be done, I think, with lasers. I mean, you couldn't do that with hand tools of any kind, because it's not even as big as a human skull. It's a little bit smaller. It's kind of like the size of the Star Child, actually, in terms of the Star Child is the size of about a 12-year-old, or the size of someone about 5 feet tall. So it's a little smaller than average, but for someone 5 feet tall, it would be a perfectly normal skull. But we're talking something that's really pretty doggone small, and these teeth are small, too. And yet, the occlusions are cut into the cusps so that you have a perfect fit. And this thing is a miracle of engineering. What I like to say when I try to describe it to people is, imagine the pyramids as big as they are and as impossible as they are. This is the pyramids on a small scale that you can hold in your hand, basically. This is the complexity level, the genius level of the pyramids brought down to a human size scale. It's truly amazing. And by the way, one of the planes you can see in the rear of the head, when you get the light just right on it, you can see the whole axes of the plane. It's like two pieces of the quartz have been glued together almost. There's an absolute circular line of demarcation in the rear of the head. A big chunk, were it to get the right kind of pressure, get struck in the right kind of way, the whole rear of that head would just slide off right along the line of that thing. It's amazing how it was done. And they also say, get this, this is what impressed me too. I didn't see this, but they say you can take it out in the sun and get the sun to come on it exactly right in the rear of the head, and light will pour out of the eyes and the nose hole and will set paper on fire or any. It'll start fires. That's amazing. And also they say that if you do light just a certain way up under the neck hole, that light will go up into the body of it and then band around through the zygomatic arches, through the cheekbones. It'll sweep around through there and come and light up the face. It's like those cheekbones have been designed as tubes of light. I didn't see that either, but this is, again, what they said would happen. We were just in a kind of a darkened room looking at it, so that the light, when he did shine it, made it really light up. But it's just an amazing, amazing artifact from nothing more than an engineering standpoint. Now, you add in the fact that so many people claim that they feel metaphysical things out of it. Sensitives and people like that swear up and down that they can feel vibrations out of it. And who knows, George, this skull could be the repository of all the knowledge in the universe, because, you know, microchips are made of quartz. That skull could be holding more information than we can conceive of if we just knew how to tap it out. And maybe someday we will. But that skull is special. I mean, there's no, in my mind, there's, it's like the Mayan calendar. It can't be there, but it is.
Does it look like there is a place for a key or anything like that in the skull?
No, there are two little bitty holes drilled in the back of it as balance points. It apparently is meant to balance on something so that the, it can rock back and forth with the, like the movement of a breeze, and the jaw would then, if the jaw was hanging down, it would look like it was talking. It's got a design like that, but as far as any kind of like a key or something like that, I think somebody's just going to have to figure out how to put some wires on it and just pull it out if it's in there. And I suspect there's probably, why would they go to that kind of trouble? Of course, they could have lost it. It was lost. It was buried in a, supposedly buried in a Mayan temple. It could easily
have
been lost.
That's where she apparently found it.
That's
right?
Where she apparently found it, exactly. But let's just keep in mind that quartz chips are how we run computers. They hold incredible amounts of knowledge. And if you had that whole head full of stuff, it just boggles. It's a universe of knowledge in this one skull.
There have always been rumors, though, that the father, that F.A., Mitchell Hedges, that he found this, but he couldn't tell anybody how he did it because it was so strange and unusual.
That's quite, I've heard that too. That's one of the things that they talked about there, and that is possible. You just don't know, because they came out with the story that she did it and they stuck with it. There is that rumor, but he's gone, she's gone. They took it to their graves. I don't know who else would know. Maybe there is somebody out there that knows the truth and they might come forward with it, but at this point, I don't know how we're ever going to prove that.
What if the skull was like a projector? And somehow, if you could get it turned on, it could show you and reveal maybe some of the secrets of the universe. Wouldn't that be something? So maybe there is information in it, like a computer chip, but that through the eyes, it kind of like shows you a hologram or something.
This was not mentioned, George. I like this
idea.
That's
my theory.
I like that idea. That's another one. It could be. That's a great way to. I mean, the idea of the chip was mentioned. This was not. It's first I've heard of it, but I think it's a great idea and a great possibility.
Let's talk more about your hominoid research for the rest of this hour, if we can, Lloyd, and then we'll take phone calls with you next hour as well.
Okay.
You've still been working on, when I first met you on the radio,
right?
Back in
St. Louis.
Yep, doing my local show.
Yeah, you had that great bumper music. I want everybody to know he had the great bumper music even then. I used to rave about it even then.
Everything You Know Is Wrong. I remember the title of that, and I went searching for you. I had heard you on with Art, and I said, what a great title for a book. Everything You Know Is Wrong. It was about how what's up is down and what's down is up, and you've never stopped since.
Right. Well, that book put me on the map, and it's been very good to me over the years. I have to say that, and a lot of people, like 30,000 people, have bought that book, so it's done very well. But we let it go out of print last year because I knew I was going to be revising it sometime this year, and I'm about one third of the way through that revision. But you know, with 10 years of new work to catch up and incorporate in, there is an awful lot, and now that I've had this delay with the documentary deal beginning to shape up and form, I'm going to be even more delayed. I don't think that the revision is going to come out until 2010, probably now. But I want everybody to know that I'm working really hard on it. I apologize for letting it go out of print because I've got an awful lot of people mad at me over that.
We will know in January if Sci-Fi wants to pick up our television program as a regular series.
Uh-huh.
If they do, would you be willing to come on with the Crystal Skull and the group and come on and do a show with us on that?
Well, I can't do it with the Star Child because that's going to be exclusive to the documentary that's being done. That's part of the deal why they're putting up so much money. I mean, they're putting up, you know,
What if we promote the documentary for you?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to talk to them. I can put you in touch with Matt Richards. He's the producer, and see how he, you know, what they're willing to do. But I know that he's going to have to work through the production company, I mean, through the channel in England. I'm not supposed to say which channel it is.
I know, I understand.
I'm supposed to say which company it is here in the States that have partnered with them on it. But they're big, trust me.
Okay, get them in touch with us at least.
Yeah, if that's something that you guys want to do, I'd have absolutely no problem with it. And also, too, remember, I can do anything relative to my human origins work, relative to hominoids work, but it may be that the Star Child is off the table for until this documentary is shown.
What do you think of Michael Cremo's work?
Love Michael Cremo.
Yeah, you two are very similar.
What a great guy. He's just one of my best friends in the whole field, and every time we're together at conferences, we spend some time together, and he's just a terrific guy. It's funny because we really have some basic disagreements about humans. You know, he says that we go back for millions of years, which is, you know, the basis of belief that from which he operates. But and I believe that our genetics say pretty clearly that we're only 200,000 years old max, and that we, as we are about 40,000-50,000 years old. But
you believe we were altered. We were
were genetically engineered, and recently. I think we're a very recent addition to the planet. I think that our genes make that clear. And I think that the genetic engineering that we have, especially our second and third chromosome, you know, the main argument there is that all higher primates have 48 chromosomes, 24 from the mother, 24 from the father. Humans alone among the higher primates have 46. Now, that's a huge loss of chromosome. And, you know, chromosome material, genes,
we're,
all of that.
We're up on the pecking order, but we've got less. Huh?
Exactly. So how could that be? Well, the truth of it is we still have them. We still have all 48 of them. But the second, our second and third, what would be second or third if we were a primate, have been stuck end to end together to take up only one space, meaning that something wanted to have sex with us and reproduce with us, but they only had 46. So they had to find a way to let us keep our full genetic component so we would be what we are, primate, but be able to have sex and reproduce with them. So they fused our second and third chromosome to go along with that program, and that can only be done in a lab. And I mean, it's just clear as a bell. Anybody looks at our genetic array can see that there's just, you know, you will hear arguments from science that, well, nature does that because it's done it in more than human beings. It's done it in other animals and plants. Well, yeah, but all of those are domesticated animals and plants, and really that's all we are, is a domesticated animal. For whoever created the domesticated animals and plants, they created us too. And I think that that's one of the hallmarks. But we also have nine other chromosomal, what are called flips. Parts of our chromosomes relative to chimps and gorillas have been just flipped end on end, just taken out, turned over, and put back in for whatever reason. And that's what makes us us. So, you know, the evidence for genetic manipulation is just blindingly clear to anybody that wants to open their eyes and see it.
Now, does a fish have the same amount of chromosomes as we do?
No, everything has different amounts.
Different amounts. Sorry.
Different amounts, yeah. And plants can have outrageous numbers. They can have layers of chromosomes. It's all very different, but as far as we're just within the primates, the things that are closest to us, the things that we're most like, that's the 46, 48, but you can have many more.
But will all fish have the same amount of numbers?
No, everything's different. Yeah, just like every animal's different. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Amazing. Stay with us, Lloyd. More to come on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, why is it so important for us to determine where we came from, who we are?
You know, I don't think we can chart a path, an accurate path into the future, till we know where we've come from, what we are, what our purpose is, why we're here, who put us here, all of that. How can we begin? We're like just like wandering around, like, as Amy says, headless chooks, which is a headless chicken here. You know, we're just wandering, and the results just look around us at what we're doing to the planet and everything. We don't have a purpose, a direction. We haven't charted a star to follow, and until we do that, till we know where we've come from, what we're about, why we're here, we just can't move forward efficiently and effectively. And I think it's important for those things to be cleared up once and for all. What do you put 10 years into something like the Starchild Skull for, if you don't really have a passionate belief that you're serving, the better good of everyone by it? It's a hard thing to do. I mean, it's a really hard thing to do. And I wouldn't do it if I didn't believe that it was very important for us to chart that accurate course into the future. I won't see it. You probably won't see it. But if we don't make those kinds of decisions, if we don't figure it out and start at least tacking in the right direction, who knows where it's all going to end? I think it's going to end badly.
It very well could be. What do you think of Zechariah Sitchin's theories about the Sumerians?
I follow his theories very closely, and I believe that there is a lot to it. He may not be right in every detail. I say that all the time because he's just one guy doing an enormous amount of research. But I think he's closer to the reality of what happened in the past than any mainstream scientist working today. Whatever they're putting out, that's all garbage. I think Sitchin is much closer to the truth. I think maybe we can get a little closer to the truth, but definitely there were, I think, a high alien superior civilization on the earth in the past, and I think some aspect of that created us and put us here for some reason, and we are yet to figure out the reason. Obviously, we don't even yet accept that that's how we got here, but through my work and the work of others like me, we can move us in that direction. The Star Child is certainly going to give us a huge leap in that direction. And then once those theories are accepted as plausible and real, then we can begin, I think, to move in that right direction. And that's the importance of the Starchild Skull, of the documentary, of the book, of all of it. And that's why it's important for people to make themselves aware of this, because this is the thing. This is the wedge. This is the lever that we're going to be able to apply to all the ignorance that's out there and is accepted now as true.
How about von Däniken, his work?
Well, I think he's the grandfather of us all, and we all owe him a huge debt of gratitude for what he's done. Same thing, not right in every single thing that he did, but he certainly did a lot of very good work. And again, one man working this whole brand new field, you're going to take some wrong paths. You have to. And we all stand on the shoulders of giants. That's the way it works. And I applaud him and Sitchin and all the early pioneers of this field. They did great work.
Lloyd, you continue with your work. It hasn't ended yet. You're still doing more research. You've got more things to do. Let's talk about some other things that you plan to do to get to the bottom of all of this.
Well, obviously the Star Child is the main thrust right now. I'm going to continue to do my work on human origins with the research that I'm doing for Everything You Know Is Wrong, and I continue to go in that direction. I want to continue my work with hominoids because I think that's just as important as the alien UFO question, because it's all together. If we are indeed put here, genetically engineered and put here, then what are called the prehumans? Those skeletons are there. Those fossils are there, and they have to be explained. Well, if you accept that hominoids are real, then the prehumans are taken care of. So it all the work that I do, it seems disparate, but it all fits together seamlessly in the end. That's how you make the picture clear to the future, to those that don't understand it. You show how the prehumans are not humans at all. They're actually hominoids that have walked out of the Miocene era, which is from 25 million years ago to 5 million years ago, walked out of that whole 20 million year period on two legs right to today. Around the world, every continent except Antarctica, four different types, the hobbit being one of those types, the little kind. And so then that leaves us without a place, human beings without a place in the fossil record. And so it makes it's just added proof that we are genetically engineered and recently put here. And that's the whole thrust of my work and what I do, and I'm going to continue to do that. And this documentary should hopefully give me a much larger platform to get, you know, to get these messages across to people. And eventually somebody, you know, somebody in the right high places are going to have to listen. They're going to do it unwillingly, but it's just we're going to be able to cram it down their throats. And I think this documentary and the test that's going to, that the Star Child is going to go through, the 454 life science testing procedure, is going to prove it at a level of scientific accuracy that just can't be argued with. And that's what makes it exciting, and that's what makes it so valuable.
Now, you said something about the hobbits. You said the little ones.
Right.
Does that kind of implies that there are big ones?
Yeah, there are four kinds of hominoids, George. There's the big kind, the Bigfoot Sasquatch kind, 7 to 9 feet tall, 700 to 1,000 pounds. There are two basically man-sized kinds. There's the Alma's kind, which are 5 to 7 feet tall, 300 to 500 pounds. There's the abominable snowman kind, which is very unique. They're the most primitive of the four.
The Yeti type?
The Yeti type, exactly that. And then there's the Sadapa, Agagwi, and now Hobbit type. They were known as Sadapas and Agagwis before, but they're found in the band of jungle that circles the equator around the globe. And they were always known to be in Indonesia and places like where the Hobbit was found. And the people on the island say these are just the little hairy people that live in the jungles. And that, you know, that's what everyone there agrees that these beings have existed alongside them all the way. Science, of course, doesn't want to accept that, and so they've done everything they can to make it seem like the Hobbit is just some kind of a dwarf, weird, mal-shaped, malformed human being, just like they try to do with the Star Child. And yet there's been some recent proof in looking at the wrist bones of the Hobbit that shows very clearly that they're not human. I mean, I've got that picture on your website as well, so people can see that analysis of those wrist bones, and which shows clearly that the hobbits are not human beings. They are much more like primates. Therefore, I argue that they are nothing more than the pygmy type hominoids that have been well known for decades.
How many different creatures do you think there have been on the planet in terms of species that have been altered or genetically manipulated?
I think that all of the so-called domesticated plants and domesticated animals have been genetically engineered to make them domesticated. They have all signs of work done to them that nature just doesn't do. Now, like a chimp or a primate, chimp or a gorilla, rather, those are just natural beings, you know, natural animals.
To this planet.
To this planet. But a cheetah? Now, a cheetah is clearly a genetically engineered animal. It's a absolute cross between a dog and a cat. It's got dog and cat fur on its body. It's got a cat body, but it's got dog feet because to run at the 70-mile-an-hour speed that a cheetah runs at, it can't make its turns on cat feet. It has to have dog feet. It has to have permanent claws stuck out there and big, heavy pads to make, like, track shoes on it, or it can't make its cuts. So, and cheetahs get dog diseases, and they get cat diseases that are specific to dogs and specific to cats. They are very, very fragile. The sperm of their males is like 40% motile. That's not, nature doesn't do that. Nature doesn't produce those kinds of problems. A cheetah is clearly a designed animal, and there are others as well. Like house cats, but cattle, sheep, goats, all of those, according to Sitchin and according to the Anunnaki, all these things, these animals and these plants, corn, wheat, all that, were created to, quote, I love this phrase, give the gods their ease, meaning to make life easy for the gods. They created everything they needed here to make their life comfortable. And that's where suddenly, remember, all this happens within about 10,000 years. Suddenly you have this explosion of domesticated plants and animals. And then we don't make any more. They just no more appear. We can't create any. Nobody creates any. No more new ones come. But within that 10,000-year period, it seems like all of them appear. how does that happen naturally? Well, it doesn't. It's just stupid to pretend that it is otherwise. And these are things that I talk about already in Everything You Know Is Wrong in the old version, and I'll just expand on that in the new version when it comes out.
Interesting facts about a cheetah. From standing start, a cheetah can reach 45 miles an hour in 2 seconds.
And 70 at top speed.
Yeah. Can you believe that?
Well, and not only that, it's the easiest big cat to domesticate. They were domesticated in all the great temples and of the kings of Egypt and all over in Asia, the Chinese court. They're very easy to domesticate. It's like they're built to be servants of humans. It's like they're built to be hunters for humans. You know how we have birds of prey that go out and hunt for us and bring it back?
Right.
Cheetahs can and will do the same thing. You take them out, they'll hunt for you and bring it back.
Without eating.
Yeah, and you give them a piece of it, and that's their reward, and it's a teamwork thing. So, they are our like shotguns, basically the primitive shotgun. Just send them out there, and they'll get it and bring it back to you.
Lloyd, what has your life been like with all these various investigations? Hominoids, Star Child, has it been turned upside down?
No, it's hectic and it's challenging, but I really love it. I don't make a lot of money. I got to tell you, anybody that you just don't make money in this field. You know that. You know it as well as I do.
Yeah.
It's not a way to make money. It's a way to find emotional satisfaction in what you do, and I certainly get my share of that. I love what I do. It isn't very rewarding yet, but maybe it will be. But I'm not in it for that. If I was in it for money, I'd have been a lawyer. I like doing what I do. I really enjoy it.
You love the speaking, too. I can tell just in the places I've seen you.
I do. I love, getting up in front of people. I just like making it clear. I like, explaining it to people and letting them see and come up to me afterwards and say, I never understood this before, but it now I understand it. That's why I want, let me just, if I can, again, plug the book again. Please, everyone listening, if you can, make yourself aware of what I'm talking about with the Star Child. Do it. Get the book if you can. Just go to the website if you can't do that. The book's easily available through Amazon. Again, if you want the hardback, go to www.bellappbooks.com or call the 800 number, 1-800-992-4821. It isn't going to make me rich, but it'll make you rich in knowledge and understanding of this incredible event that's going to come down the pipe this year, and you will be prepared for it. You'll be able to discuss it with your friends and your enemies and the people that make fun of you. You're going to be able to rub their noses in it. And I really urge you to make yourself aware, understand it, understand the arguments, understand why the genetics are going to work. The pages, the pictures are there in the book on the website for you to show and prove what I'm telling you. Just make yourself understand so you can explain it and make them understand it.
Why do you think scientists kind of shy away from what you call searching for the truth?
Because they just simply don't want to have to say they're wrong. I've got a book. I really would like you to contact a guy named Christopher Hardiker. There's a book called The First American that came out last year. You want to hear a story that'll curl your hair about science, this will do it. In the Valsequillo, and I'm not sure that I say this right because of the Spanish, but the Valsequillo Reservoir, back in the 60s, George, they started discovering artifacts that when they dated them, they dated out to 250,000 years ago. This is near Mexico City. 250,000 years ago, worked stone tools. Now, this flew so badly in the face of the Clovis first theorists who say that the first Americans, the first people to come to the Americas, had to come at the end of the last ice age, and the Clovis points were the first and all that. Imagine from 12 to 15,000 years ago as the upper limit for when mainstream science would accept that human, type people were here, to 250,000 years ago minimum and possibly more than 1,000,000 years ago in this one area. And all the things that they do, that science does to squash this down and not let this come out, known in the 60s, mind you, and they succeed for 35 years. And then a woman who was there named Virginia Steen McIntyre comes on a documentary in the late 90s, 30 some odd years later, and just the roof blows off, and they have to re-squash it down again from having her come on, and her career was ruined by being involved in it and everything. This is an incredible story of scientific malfeasance at the highest level. It's called The First American. The guy is Christopher Hardiker, and your audience would be absolutely enthralled by this guy's story, by the Valsequillo story. I know I was. It's a great book. I would recommend it to anybody. Just like the Upright Ape, although that's a lot more difficult reading, The Upright Ape by Dr. Aaron Fuller. He's the one that found that the Miocene apes, there were indeed upright walking Miocene apes through the entire Miocene. That's a much more scientifically technical book, and I don't think it would be as much fun to read as The First American. That's the way I write, where anybody can read it and enjoy it.
Lloyd, isn't it amazing how so many past civilizations discuss through their tablets and their writings and their symbols extraterrestrial presence? I mean, it is so cut and dry.
Absolutely. So cut and dry and consistent across all of those cultures. You would think that with that much anecdotal evidence coming out of the historical record, that one scientist would look at another one and say, you know, maybe these people knew what they were talking about. You know, instead of just, well, we choose not to believe it, so they have to all be complete morons and not know anything about what they were talking about.
Dramatic research on your part, and I hope everything falls into place.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the support you and the Coast to Coast staff have given me over the years, including Art. It's been a long decade for all of us, but we're really close to fruition here, George, and I'm happy to be able to announce it tonight and to share it with you and all of your listeners.
I can hear it in your voice.
I mean,
there have been moments of frustration, but this time I hear it in your voice that you feel
relief. Relief is not even the word for this. I mean, can you imagine having someone call you up and say, "We're willing to put in whatever it takes. Get us a number. We want to do this." And I get the number, and it's $200,000. And I call them back, and there's a big gulp on the end of the line. And they say, let me get back to you on that. They go out, they find some partners that are willing to come in on it, and we've got a deal. It's amazing.
Well, and they're going to do it right.
Well, the main point is, look, if they're going to put up that kind of money, you know they've already studied the book, studied what I do, and they know it's a good gamble. It's a good risk. It's not even a gamble. They know it's going to happen, or they wouldn't do it. Nobody would put up that kind of money if they weren't sure, it was as sure as I am, that it was going to happen. It's going to happen.
It'll happen. Stay with us, Lloyd, because what's going to happen next, when we come back at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you. Lloyd's got a couple websites linked up at coasttocoastam.com, lloydpye.com, P-Y-E, and then starchildproject.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And you, because you're going to make phone calls now with Lloyd Pye, our special guest on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, do you think some scientists would do whatever they could do to get you to stop doing and the testing on the Star Child?
Well, I think some would if they knew what I was doing. For the most part, this has been a very low-profile program for the whole, 10 years. Even though it's been on television and, the programs that we talked about earlier, it's not the kind of thing that mainstream science concerns itself with. They just don't pay attention. I think we're going to be able to blindside them on it, frankly. Now, the word may get out. But I don't think they can stop it now. I think it's at a point of, it's reached critical mass. It's becoming known at high enough levels to where people are putting serious money down to find out the answer. And I think they have a very strong intuition about what that answer is going to be, or they wouldn't be putting that kind of money down. So that's why, this is an exciting time. And I don't think there's a lot that science can do now to stop it. I think its profile is up high enough in certain circles, certainly everybody that's been listening to your show, and that's millions of people over the years, there's a lot of folks out there that would be able to hoop and holler if something were to go wrong with this. And that's why I urge everybody to make themselves even more familiar with what we've done already with the Star Child. So if anybody does try to stop us, we can raise a furor and get them to back down on it.
Okay, let's go to some of the calls. We'll go to David driving around in St. Louis. You're on the air with us. Hello, David.
Yeah, hey, George. I got a question.
Sure thing.
It seems like most scientists are evolutionists, and that would be the reason for butting heads there with Lloyd. I was wondering, since his theory falls more in line with the story of Genesis, has he had any support from any religious organizations?
I don't know if you heard him at all, Lloyd.
I really didn't hear it, George. Could you tell me what he said?
One more time, because you're breaking up just a bit, David.
I'm sorry about it, George. Sure. I was wondering if he had any support from any religious organization, since his theory falls more in line with the story of Genesis than it does evolution.
Okay. Any support with religious groups behind what you do, Lloyd?
No, not a bit. And in fact, I heard what he said, that this falls more in line with Genesis than with evolution. It really doesn't fall in line, I don't think, with Genesis at all, really. I don't think either religion or science is going to be necessarily happy about accommodating alien reality. I think religion will have an easier time of it than science, but I don't think that either one of them are going to be particularly happy about having to alter their framework to accommodate these things. This reality, I think, is going to be unwelcome in both camps.
Kathy in Washington, state of. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Lloyd and George.
Hello.
My question is, have they ever tried to hook up fiber optics to those two little drilled holes in the back of the crystal skulls?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Mr. Holman, the guy that now, controls the Mitchell Hedges skull. Anna Mitchell Hedges died, I think, last year, and she put Bill Holman, in charge of it, kind of in the way that I'm in charge of the Star Child skull. And you'd have to ask him that. I really don't know. Sorry.
Are they in contact with any spiritualist churches? Because I first heard about this crystal skull in a spiritualist church in Seattle?
Well, they deal a lot with metaphysics. Metaphysical people who are interested in metaphysics and spiritual things, tend to use crystals as a medium for that, crystal skulls being, a particular kind of crystal that they use. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. Again, I have to admit this, I'm not much of a crystal skull person. I'm not that knowledgeable about it. I got this experience with the Mitchell Hedges skull because, like everybody, I think I'm interested in that one simply because it's so unusual in the world of crystal skulls. All the rest of them are fairly normal, and it's clear that they've been carved, and they even have histories, and they know when they were carved, where they were carved, whatever. But the Mitchell Hedges skull is a huge, giant mystery, and I think it's going to remain that way for quite some time.
Okay. I had a psychic tell me in that church that the crystal skulls actually contain a real entity, a real being.
Right. Again, that's better left for Bill Holman to deal with. It's really not my field, and it's not my artifact.
But the Star Child. That's another question.
That's another question, right? But not like the crystal skull.
How closely does it resemble a gray? And you said originally people thought it might have been.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. If you go with the standard outline, now don't think about the gray on the cover of the book Communion, because while that is the archetypal figure of a gray, it is in fact not how grays look. There was an article in a MUFON journal a couple of years ago by Bud Hopkins in which he explained very clearly that the cover of Communion is used as a litmus test by researchers frequently in dealing with abductees, and they'll show that cover and say, is this what you saw? And if they say, yeah, yeah, it looked a lot like that, then they know right away that this is a person who's not necessarily telling the truth, because that is not the standard depiction of what they're given. It's really like the Star Child, which is, again, that heart-shaped face instead of that glowering kind of elongated face that you see on the communion cover. It looks like a heart with, you know, upper crown, you know, a dent in the middle, in the rear of the head, and then coming down to a very thin, small, narrow, almost pointed lower face, and that is what the Star Child has.
Okay, thank you. Steve, Chicago, Illinois, east of the Rockies. Steve, you're on with Lloyd.
Yeah, how you guys doing?
Good.
All right, my question's got to do with the Star Child skull.
Okay, that he can answer.
If I'm correct, you guys said that when the girl found the skull, she found the skeleton too, right?
No. She found the skull what?
She found the skeleton with the skull?
Yeah, she found two full skeletons in a mine tunnel. There was one skeleton exposed on the surface lying on its back. There was another buried, a mound of dirt beside that one, and coming out of that mound of dirt was what she called a misshapen hand emerging from the dirt. And that hand was wrapped around the upper arm bone of the one laying on the surface of the mine tunnel. So because it was in a mine tunnel, there was no compaction of the soil by rain or anything, so she was able with her bare hands to scrape that dirt away to see where the hand was coming from, and she exposed a whole skeleton smaller than the one on the surface, and that one was about 5 feet tall based on the size of the skull. So we assume that the Star Child skeleton, which is the one that was in the ground in the grave, was about 4 feet tall, and so she attempted to recover both skeletons. I won't take the time about what happened, but it's all in the book if anybody wants to explore it to that degree. And she ended up with just the two skulls, banged up a little bit, lost the jaws. It all got swept away in a flood, long story, but she did recover the two skulls that we have now that represent them, and a piece of maxilla, upper right maxilla, of the Star Child.
Okay, good. Next up, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Darcy, first-time caller. Hey, Darcy.
Hi, George and Lloyd. How are you tonight?
Good, Darcy.
Just listening to Lloyd, it kind of reminds me of a photo that's always kind of stuck in the back of my head from early last century, which was the Deloitte's ape. Has Lloyd's research gone into looking at that type of creature at all?
Yeah, I have. The Deloitte's ape is, from my understanding of it, is just really a large monkey, a South American monkey, that someone fairly recently gave a type name to. It was distorted and bloated somewhat from death, which gave it a little bit of size. You know, it had already begun the bloating process from death to give it some extra size relative to that kind of monkey. But they said if you reduced it down, that it would be that kind. But yes, that is a very famous photo, and I am aware of it.
Okay, thank you.
Lloyd, what other things are you investigating? Are you just concentrating right now on the documentary and the Star Child project?
No, I'm absolutely running on two tracks, as I always do. I have one foot firmly planted in the UFO alien thing with the Star Child, but I have the other foot just as firmly planted in the world of hominoids and human origins with my work with Everything You Know Is Wrong. So in my spare time, when I'm not involved with the Star Child, I work on revising Everything You Know Is Wrong. And I think I'm probably the only researcher in the world that has, you know, has feet firmly planted in those two worlds. And I'll tell you just an interesting anecdote about
it.
When I speak to a hominoid crowd, they absolutely believe that because they've either seen it or they know somebody that has, but they believe it 100%, but they don't believe necessarily in UFOs and aliens. You go talk to a UFO alien crowd, and they firmly believe in it. They've seen one. They know somebody that has. They believe it. But they don't necessarily believe in hominoids. Why? Because they believe what science tells them about the other thing. They know science is wrong about when science, if you believe in Bigfoot and science says, you know, Bigfoot's wrong, well, they know science is wrong there. But science says that UFOs and aliens, well, they don't know, so they take their word for it. And it's the same way on the other side of the coin. I'm always amazed that somebody with a perfectly open mind in one area because they've seen and they know for a fact will blindly accept what they're told about the other subject. It's amazing to me.
Okay, let's go to San Diego. Derek, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Derek.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, Derek.
How you doing, Lloyd?
I'm fine.
My question is kind of in like the first caller's sort of question when it comes to not really being religious or anything. I don't know how much you know about Genesis, but a lot of the things you're saying just really just intrigues me because, you know, in Genesis it talks about the six fingers, six toes, you know, the giants, you know, and you had mentioned that, you know, of course we've heard about finding giants. And earlier you had mentioned about the Anunnaki. Earlier you had mentioned that, said it real quickly.
Right.
So I know, I see that you do, you know, have some, you know, more of what's being, you know, going here. Also, I wanted to say, my question is how much of genetics that can be changed, or when you talk about the chromosomes can be changed, How much genetics do you think can keep it from us from having? Because we have spirits and stuff, and I wanted to know if we're being genetic. That's kind of like making me think about, you know, like what we're going on right now. You know, taking some DNA from somebody and, you know, and creating George again. So
I don't know if we want to do that.
So what I think about genetics, that's what comes to my mind. So I just wanted to know that you said that we were domesticated, you know, animals, and it makes sense to me because cows and all this stuff popped up out of nowhere. And
right.
I just wanted to know, do you believe the spiritual part of it? Like, how does genetics have to do with also in the spiritual realm, though? How do you differentiate? You're like, how can you just, you know what I mean?
Well, I really, you know, obviously that's a question that nobody can answer definitively. I can give you the suggestion that about 5% of our genome actually seems to function to produce proteins, to do all the work of our bodies. Most of our genetic code is what's called junk DNA. They don't understand what it does. They don't understand why it reproduces so faithfully if it doesn't seem to have any kind of obvious use to us. Why is the bulk of our genome useless, basically useless? It doesn't make sense. So let's assume that possibly that is what carries spirit. That is what transfers spirit. That is what, you know, where spirit is housed, if indeed spirit is real, and I'm in no position to say that is true, and neither are you. We're told it is, but, you know, still there's no proof. But junk DNA, for lack of a better explanation for what it's doing there and why our bodies, you know, conserve it so, quote, religiously, no pun intended, that might be the answer right there.
Okay, great. Thank you, Derek. Next up, one more before the break. Richard in St. Louis, you're up with us. Hey, Richard.
Hey, great to talk to you guys. I got two questions. Two for the guests.
Sure.
And one for George at the end. Now, the first is a clarification. When you say hominoid, do you use that term interchangeably with hominid? Because I know for a fact that there are more than four identified hominids.
Use hominoid in the sense of upright, walking, hair-covered primate, indigenous primate of planet Earth, hominoids. That's Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Almas, a Yeti, abominable snowman, Agagwe, Sedapas, like that, the four different kinds. Hominoids, upright walking, hair-covered, right, bipedal creatures that are indigenous to planet Earth.
Okay, now how do the Habilis, Erectus, Neanderthal, Ancestor, Florensis,
they're all called hominids.
Right.
Part of us, you know, they're just pre-humans. They are collectively grouped by science as humans simply because they walk upright. Even though there's not a human bone in their bodies, there's not a human aspect to their face. Again, the big brow ridges, the big night vision eyes, the lack of foreheads, all of that. They're still nonetheless classified as human, therefore hominids. And I say that they are, in fact, hominoids.
Okay, now my second question actually kind of answers it. Now, are the the wrist bones the only criteria you're using for the Homo floresiensis, the hobbit?
The hobbit. No, it's not the only criterion, but I say again, and you can see this on the 60 Minutes interview about it, where the guys who found it say, no, there's not really any human bone. All the bones are bigger, more robust, exactly like with all the hominoids. The skull, all you can do is look at the skull, the big round eyes, the big brow ridges, the lack of the forehead, all of that is consistent with the pre-human skulls, but they were still able to make the argument that, well, it's a deformed human, it's got to be a human, it's upright, it's got to be some kind of deformed human. Except when they looked at the wrist bones really carefully, they found humans have a distinctive kind of wrist, and primates have a distinctive different kind of wrist. And the hobbit wrist is much more like primates than it is like humans, so it's clear it's not a human because it doesn't have a human wrist.
Okay.
All right.
All right, also for George, I actually sent you an email. I'm an artist. My name is Prince E. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and it was a video I sent you. It was called Bars from Sumer. I just wanted to know if you checked it out.
I think Tommy's got it first, Richard. He's looking at it.
Okay.
And then he'll send it on to me.
Okay, cool.
All right, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right. The old hometown of St. Louis. Lloyd, what's home for you?
Well, a little town called Amite, Louisiana, which is just north of Hammond, about 60 miles north of New Orleans.
Small family? Big family?
Three siblings and myself, and I spring from the soil, George. I grew up in a little small town.
Do they love the work you do?
No.
Really?
It's a red state, George.
Yeah.
It's deep in the heart of a red state. Now, I mean, you know, I have my friends just, they're bemused by what I do, but they don't really understand it. You know, most people just don't understand it. It's so far beyond the country life, they just can't begin to grasp it.
Really. I got to tell you, Lloyd, this audience is so unusual in that they do understand. They understand what you do. They understand this economic situation. They're brilliant.
They are this audience for this show is probably the most in-tuned together on top of it group of people massed together in one place in this country that probably there is.
We're coming right back. We'll take final phone calls with Lloyd Pye. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm fascinated with your work, Lloyd. I always have been. I mean, it's at one time, I know it's been frustrating getting some of these answers, but it's also got to be challenging for you, huh?
It is. It's very difficult, very challenging, and it's always interesting, and that's what makes it valuable to me. It's never boring, always interesting. There's always the next page you turn over in a book could be the thing that'll just jump out and solve some major problem. You just never know. You got to just keep reading, keep digging,
and never stop. How much support are you beginning to pick up?
Well, none really so far, except for what's happened here with the documentary. I'm hoping that some will come along. You know, we've just been eking our way along like everybody in this field does, but we're hoping for, you know, a real breakthrough. It's still going to be another year. I've got to get through this year to get through to the goal line of when the program airs. But when that happens, things should really pick up. And I would think as we move toward the resolution of the testing, things will begin to pick up as well. I would say from the middle to the end of next year should be a good time. I just have to get from here to there.
Let's talk a little bit about The Hobbit, discovered in 2004. How intelligent do you think these things were?
Well, I think they're as intelligent as any of the other hominoids. I think they're hominoids. I think they're smarter than chimps, smarter than gorillas, not as smart as us, but smart enough to make tools, you know, tools in the sense of chip rocks and turn them into working devices, maybe weave fibers into, you know, blankety-type things or things to sit on. You know, just basic stuff, build shelters, you know, use brush to build shelters, things like that. Certainly mimic animals, hunt, do, you know, I think not human, but still smart, smarter than chimps, smarter than gorillas.
All right, to the phones we go. People are waiting for you. Santa Clara, California. Hey, Edward, go ahead.
Yeah, should we go explore the Sidonia region of Mars to find out if the Star Child's ancestors may have come from that area?
Well, that's an interesting possibility, Lloyd.
Well, anything is possible. You're right. But I think, you know, it's been hard enough to get somebody to put up a couple of hundred thousand.
Here.
So to get them to go to Mars just to look for that, I don't see that anytime, you know, not in my lifetime anyway.
Past civilizations, do any of them have anything that could be similar with the Star Child?
I don't know. You know, past civilizations living on Earth, anything's possible there. That feels wide open. There's certainly a lot of, getting back to Michael Cremo, there's certainly a lot of ooparts, you know, out-of-place artifacts that go back millions of years, and they're very sophisticated, some of them. So clearly there's been a lot of action on this planet going back millions of years. Is that human beings? No. Human beings as we are, as you and I and everybody listening, our genetic heritage only goes back about 200,000 years max. So whatever was here playing around and leaving artifacts behind that are found by, you know, the research of people like Michael Cremo, those are not human beings. They're something else.
Let's go to Vinny in Brooklyn, New York. You're on the air with us. Go ahead, Vinny.
Hey guys. How are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, George. Hey, Lloyd. You were on TV today. We're watching the Star Child, my brother and I. We're watching that earlier this evening. It was a good program. It's very exciting. It's definitely everything that's happening. I'm very looking forward to the outcome of this, and definitely very excited. You were talking about the genetics, and you were saying there would be a difference. I mean, what's going to be the difference? Are you going to be able to say, you know, this is alien DNA, or is it just it's going to be different DNA? I'm not exactly. You were saying.
Well, there's no way, Vinny, to say that it's alien DNA. It's going to establish what alien DNA looks like. What we're going to be able to tell from this test is how far away from human DNA this DNA lies in terms of change. In other words, right now we have recovered the entire human genome. We have basically all 3 billion base pairs, all 25,000 genes, you know, that make up the chromosomes. We have the whole package, same for chimps, same for gorillas, and soon it will be same for Neanderthal. So we're talking 3 billion units of information that either match up or don't match up. Now, the vast majority of it matches up. With humans and chimps, it's 97% the same. With gorillas and humans, it's 95% the same. And there'll be some percentage like that with Neanderthals. So what we are going to be able to determine from the Star Child's genome, all 3 billion base pairs or however many it has, you'll be able to lay them down and compare them to human beings one by one by one right through all 3 billion so that you get a percentage of difference. How many are different? Instead of, instead of this one here, it's something different right on down the line. That percentage will tell us how far away it is, and if it's any significance, anything over than like, you know, a fraction of a percent, it's not a human being, because a human being is a human being by definition of falling within these parameters of being, you know, of its genome. So the Star Child will absolutely be well away. The question is how far away, but whatever it is away, it's going to establish the baseline of alien DNA. We don't have any any at this point, but now we're going to, just like we need, like George was saying earlier, we need hominoid DNA, and when we get it, we'll be able to do the same thing with it.
Okay, real quick, so the you were saying the mitochondrial DNA that comes from the mother, is that what's going to anchor us
Mitochondrial DNA is a very small part of, but you can see the mitochondrial DNA picture on the website, and maybe that's what's confusing you. That's a very small part of the genome. It's about 16,000 base pairs long. Each little bit of mitochondrial DNA is only about 16,000. Now, that sounds like a lot. It's a big number. But compare it to 3 billion, and it's an infinitesimal fraction. You see, it's very small. So mitochondrial DNA is not going to be a big play in this at all. And we already have the Star Child's mitochondrial DNA. It comes from its mother. That's how we know it had a human mother. What we need is its father's DNA. That we don't have. That we can't recover yet so far because primers, human primers, can't pick it up because he wasn't human. That's what we knew back in 2003. What we need to know is how far was he from human, and that's what this new test, the 454 Life Science test, will give us.
Were there any pictures of the Star Child on any of the caves or anything in that area?
Not that I know of, not that I'm aware of. In fact, not in any cave drawing anywhere that I'm aware of, George, and I've seen a bunch of them.
Okay.
None that I'm aware of.
That would have been something. Let's go to Los Angeles. Hello, Nathan. Thanks for holding.
Hey, how you going, fellas?
Good, good.
Excellent. I just had a couple quick questions for Lloyd there. Just jumping back to the alien UFO abduction phenomena.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar at all with Rick Strassman's work out of the University of New Mexico?
No.
Good man.
Well, what they were doing there, they were doing a lot of government-sponsored, at least back in the 80s, early 90s, research on DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which actually they found to be a naturally occurring chemical in the brain, of course not recognized by modern science. But what they were getting out of a lot of their volunteers, and these were people that were fairly, you know, smart, intellectual individuals reporting back on this, is that it put them in a lot of conscious states that were extremely similar to alien abductions and near-death experiences. And, you know, some authors such as Rick Strassman, even guys like Terrence McKenna, who didn't, you know, experience it in the laboratory, kind of claimed that these states of consciousness are reflections of our interspatial connection to the aliens and the UFOs and our DNA and that structure. So basically, I was just wanting to know, especially with science and religion casting out the alien reality as much as they do the state of psychedelics in our society, do you think there's any connection to DMT being naturally occurring with the UFO phenomena?
I don't, you know, I really don't know. I haven't studied that research. I don't know anything about it. But I think it's pretty hard to call for example, what we were talking about earlier, a sonogram that shows a woman pregnant, and then a couple months later she's no longer pregnant. She's had a miscarriage, but no fetus has passed out. I think it would be hard to call that any kind of a psychological state. That those are real things that have happened to women that can document it. So, I just don't know enough to comment any more than to say that it could be an aspect of it, but I don't think it explains it entirely, if that's what you're suggesting.
Okay, next up, let's go to Bob trucking around in Pennsylvania. Hey, Bob.
How you doing, George?
Okay,
and,
Bob.
And also, Lloyd, how are you tonight?
I'm okay.
Good. My question tonight is twofold. First of all, George, I have to say that I admire your work, and Lloyd, I admire your work. I've listened many months, first time got through. And I wanted to find out with you, Lloyd, what are your feelings were on alien abduction of certain individuals, these sightings, people have had experiences with these short individuals, with these, I guess, oblong-type eyes and heads, and whether you believe that there is any correlation between these types of figures and those found with the Star Child. It was just an interesting thing here.
Are you talking about grays? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about some of the people that have seen UFO sightings and have reportedly seen or had experiences with these humanoid-type figures from these alien craft. And there are descriptions of them that I've seen off and on through various publications through the years with their, you know, with their type of head shape and their eyes.
Yeah, so you're saying, was that the kind of person, the one that was found with the Star Child? No. The one with the Star Child was absolutely 100% human. She was from haplogroup A. There's no question about it according to the genetics. And if you look at her head, you can see her picture on the website or in the book or wherever. You look at her head, perfectly normal human who has been cradle-boarded. The only thing unique about her is she has been legitimately cradle-boarded, which just flattens the rear portion of her head a little bit about the size of the palm of your hand. But other than that, she's 100% human, nothing unusual about her beyond that.
Okay, that was my question. And you indicated earlier in your show, Bell Lapp, I missed that point on your book.
The book can be obtained through, the hardback can be obtained through Bell Lapp Books, B-E-L-L-L-A-P, like the end of a race, the Bell Lapp, B-E-L-L-L-A-P, books.com, BellLappBooks.com. That's for the hardback. If you want the paperback, that's the collector's edition hardback. The paperback version, just go to Amazon or any of the online outfits that do it, Barnes & Noble, whatever, but I just say Amazon because, you know, that's where everybody goes. But if you want the inscribed, and by the way, the hardback, obviously, I'm going to inscribe it to whoever gets it. I'll sign it to you, and, you know, that's how it works. You sign the hardbacks. The paperbacks,
that's part of the deal.
Amazon, and I don't sign those.
You can't. It's too much. John, exactly. In Atlanta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Lloyd. George, great show.
Thank you.
So, Lloyd, I imagine you would suggest that the Star Child is probably a hybrid, right?
I mean, yes, I do. I suggest that it's a hybrid between a human mother and a non-human father, yes.
Yeah, in the alien abduction literature, you see accounts of abductees encountering their own children of all shapes and sizes, closer to more alien-looking, more human-looking. So there's probably all different kinds of varieties of hybrids that have been created by these entities that are coming here and taking people and keeping these hybrids. I would imagine that in this particular case, I guess they didn't take this hybrid and it stayed with the mother for some reason, the circumstances that surrounded her life.
We thought for a long time that the human female, we know it was a female, found with the Star Child, you know, with its arm. In other words, the Star Child died, and she buried it in that mine tunnel, in the grave in the mine tunnel. And then for whatever reason, she laid down beside it. She wrapped its arm around, its hand around her arm, and she killed herself. And she laid down and died with it.
How did she die?
Well, we don't know that. I make
weathered it, away.
Well, she could have, you know, no, she could have taken poison. She could have cut her wrist. She could have, you know, done anything to herself. So she could have died any number of ways, committed suicide, but she did die with the Star Child for them to be found in the way that girl says that she found their skeletons. So
that's sad.
You know, yeah, it's a very dramatic and romantic in a way story. So naturally, we assume that was its mother. What other woman would make that kind of a sacrifice? But when we got the DNA tested in 2003, we found out that she is from her mitochondrial DNA, meaning her mother's mitochondrial DNA, was from haplogroup A, while the Star Child's mother was from haplogroup C. So that means that the two of them were not genetically related. The Star Child's mother was a different human being. Human being, nonetheless, but from a different haplogroup.
Let's go next to Bill in Phelan, California. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, hi, George. I'm your Planet of the Apes actor friend.
That's right.
How you doing?
I'm good, good.
Well, you know I'm trained to think outside the box working
in science
fiction.
Yes, you are. Sure thing.
Right. I wonder if it's time for Lloyd to get together with Linda Moulton Howe's people and get some samples of Morgellon fibers and match them with those fibers in the skull and see if there's any correlation between those.
Well, we talked about that earlier, and maybe you missed the early part of the show, but I get this, you know, recommended to me all the time, you know, what's the connection with Morgellons fibers? There's none that we can see because Morgellons is a fiber that you can see with the naked eye. It's got some pretty good size to it, whereas the fibers embedded in the bone of the Star Child are just very microscopic. You have to look at them. You have to find them, in fact, with a scanning electron microscope. So it's like, you know, a planet versus a grain of sand. I mean, not exactly like that, but it's a very large dichotomy between the two, and they don't seem to be different colors or anything like that. They just seem to be completely different, and they're in bone, whereas Morgellon seems to be an affliction of the skin and organs.
Okay, but let me pose this to you. If they're genetically experimenting on us, like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly, I know that's a fantasy film, but when you put two life forms together, sometimes those fibers might express in slightly different ways. Maybe you should test for the actual composition of the fibers themselves. If,
well,
they don't know what the Morgellons fibers are either, and they don't know what these bone fibers are, but see if you can get a match between them. You may not know what either one is, but you might find something similar in them.
You know, I, in the future, I would bet you anything that they will be somebody that will come up with a way to recover those fibers and test them. But right now, there's no protocol for recovery or testing of those fibers. Now, I don't know, you know, what's going on with Morgellons. I don't know how seriously they're being taken yet. And it's going to take a while, I think. The Star Child is going to have to prove itself out genetically before science is going to really dig down and do every conceivable test that can be done on it. But I think that will happen, and the day will come when we will know what those fibers in the Star Child are made of.
Keep in touch, Lloyd, okay? Lloyd Pye, the Star Child skull. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.